This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The HBO drama series The Wire, which is set in Baltimore and looks at the respective activities and hierarchies of cops and criminals, has just begun its third season. It's gotten lots of critical acclaim. The San Francisco Chronicle calls it the best show on television, period. But it doesn't enjoy the high profile of other HBO shows, like The Sopranos and 6 Feet Under. David Simon, the creator of The Wire, may be a little disappointed in that, but he's not surprised. Every step of the way, he's designed his show to go against normal conventions of the genre. Simon's unflinching, realistic approach to television has attracted some respected novelists, including George Pelicanos, Richard Price, and Dennis Lehane, whose enthusiasm for The Wire has led them to write for the show. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk to David Simon and George Pelicanos. David Simon was a police reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He took a leave of absence to write a book documenting a year in the life of the city's homicide squad. That book, Homicide: A Year on the Killing Streets, was the basis for the brilliant NBC series Homicide: Life on the Street. The Wire is his third series. All three have been set and filmed in Baltimore. Crime novelist George Pelicanos is the Washington, D.C. counterpart to David Simon. His books include The Sweet Forever and Hard Revolution. All 12 of his books are set there and based on lots of firsthand research and experience about the streets and people of D.C. He joined The Wire early and is now on staff as a writer and producer. Let's start with a scene from the third season premiere of The Wire, which HBO is showing through Saturday. Stringer Bell, the second-in-command drug lord, played by Idris Elba, has been to business school and returns with some new techniques for protecting the gang's turf and profits. He holds a sort of business seminar to explain his ideas to his skeptical followers.
How are we going to stand up some corner that's not ours?
Well, we got the best product, right? So the chances are we're going to be able to bring in the competition by offering the re-up with us from our package. Feel me? Everybody making money sharing the real estate. Slim Charles.
But what if they don't cop our re-up, though?
Well, I'm going to worry about that when it happens. Until then, Mr. Charles, we're going to handle this like businessmen. Sell the make the profit, and later for that gangster bullshit.
When you were planning The Wire in the beginning, David, and trying to figure out what sort of a visual style you wanted it to have, what sort of things did you reject? What sort of things were you adamant that you wanted it to look like?
I only had one rule, and Bob Colesbury incorporated into what he did. It really was his template. I guess I should start with that template. He didn't want it to reflect the jumpiness of sort of televised cop shows. I thought Homicide broke real ground visually with what they did with 16mm handheld and, you know, the jump cuts and everything. And I thought NYPD Blue with their sort of swish pans and rack focus and all that. What they did created a whole sort of style for the 90s, but it was stylistic and it served stories that were heavily character-based. And one of the things that I wanted The Wire to be was a story told in its own time. We were very conscious of the fact that our story moves more slowly than the average episodic drama because we're not going to pay off at the end of the hour. We're going to pay off at the end of 12. And so we know we're starting in a very laconic poise, and we're going to go at our own speed, and we're going to revel in detail. And if that's the case, then the camera work has to reflect that. So we wanted more languid movements. We wanted the background to show great detail. You can watch these episodes 2 and 3 times. You'll pick up stuff in the background every single time. It's made for DVD viewing because we're actually thinking on 2 or 3 levels. We're not just rushing background by. It's not just walk-bys. There's usually something going on in the scene visually. And similarly, we didn't want the camera to have any advanced knowledge of the story. Since we're asking viewers to follow the story very carefully and to pick up facts as they go along and never to have more facts than we're allowing, it's sort of unfair to have the camera be fishing and be finding things that only the camera would know is there. So a lot of the pans and the the camera moves that were sort of typical of, you know, the last generation of cop shows really wouldn't work for The Wire. You know, when the camera moves somewhere, it's because a character looked over there or referenced something in dialogue. There's no unmotivated camera movement. And that's very different from what sort of, you know, everything has become so stylized in American television. We were really going back to sort of a very basic filmic logic.
From the second season, when you were down on the harbor, what were the visual opportunities, first of all, that you got that made The Wire look so distinctive last year? And how hard was that to pull off?
First of all, we needed the cooperation of the Port Authority in Maryland, and they were very gracious about hosting us. But it was something that Bob seized on right away. We had talked about the idea of doing something that captured the working class struggle that was going on with unionized workers in Baltimore. And we talked about early on the GM plant, Beth Steele, which was going bankrupt at the time. But there's something about those cranes. They're so beautiful and gothic. And just looking at them, standing over the harbor, they imply work. They imply the power of the city-state. They're like cathedrals. They're like steeples in the center of the town. And when they're idle, it seems to be an editorial comment. And when they're working, it seems to be an editorial comment. And so it was wonderful to frame it around the port. I don't think anyone spent any time on a port doing any storytelling since maybe On the Waterfront. And if you have the opportunity to watch that movie again, that movie crackles. And that, of course, was a time of bulk cargo, so you didn't even have all the equipment. There was just something about it that spoke to work and lost opportunities and a way of being that was dying. And it's dying in the neighborhood where I live. I mean, you know, more and more yuppies, more and more $300,000 homes, but the old Polish stevedore families are moving out.
There's also the sense last year that we were making a visual record of the city that was going away. And in fact, a lot of the places that we filmed and the things that you see in that season, they're gone already.
This is the third season of The Wire now. Can you delineate the differences between seasons 1 and 2 in just overall themes and what you're trying to do this year with the show?
Okay. Season 1 began a theme that I think will continue throughout the run of the show, which is the nature of institutions in modern culture and how individuals are affected by the institutions that they serve or are supposed to serve them. There was also an argument being made about the efficacy of the drug war in the first season. The second season expanded our facsimile of a post-industrial city of our make-believe Baltimore to include the port and what's become of the working class and basically the death of work in a country that no longer makes anything, no longer manufactures anything or uses a port to ship it out. And what's happened to those unions and those workers and those Americans. This next season, we've returned to the theme of the drug war to do something very different, which is to examine the nature of reform. And we've expanded the city once again to include a political element. We wanted to look at the idea of what reform is and what it isn't and who might genuinely be a reformer and who might not and what the possibilities are for a culture that I think is actually increasingly disenfranchised when it comes to democracy. So there's a political element there. There's also a sub-theme working, which is there's a drug war that I think people will find a certain amount of metaphor for what's happening in Iraq if they follow it carefully. So there's sort of two things going on at once. And I guess to give away a little bit more than that, we're asking a question about what would happen if one commander in one precinct in one American city decided to surrender in the drug war.
Mm-hmm.
What might actually happen?
Let me ask you a question, not of you two as writers, but you two as producers. If you care so much about telling a realistic story, how hard is it to cast realistically and then to film realistically?
We tend to like a lot of faces that you don't see on TV. I remember the first season of Homicide, Tom said with some great pride, and I think it was a little bit insulting to our actors, he said with great pride that he thought he had the ugliest show on network television. And by standards, he was probably correct, although there were a lot of very attractive people in that cast. I don't necessarily think our show is ugly or not. Or I think our show genuinely reflects a variety of people, which is what you find on the streets of Baltimore. And I'm very conscious of that. You know, if at some point everybody starts looking rigorously beautiful, it throws me out of my belief that I'm actually writing about a real place. I have problems looking at those dailies. You know, I don't want anybody to look, you know, torn down completely. But part of what made The Corner credible is not just that we took some very attractive people like, you know, Candy Alexander or Sean Nelson and tore them down a little bit, especially, you know, Candy, to get those performances, mm-hmm. but we surrounded them with a lot of people that we cast in Baltimore. You know, and we'll go into a neighborhood and we'll be shooting and the SAG extras will show up and they'll look a little bit too, extra-like. They'll look like SAG extras. And so we'll send the ADs around to grab up people who are watching the filming who look much more credible because, you know what, they live in Baltimore. They actually live on those streets. And some of them actually, upon giving the opportunity, turn out to be pretty good actors. So it's not to say that this isn't being done by professionals, because it is. I mean, we're the vast majority of our major roles are cast in the usual fashion, but we're very conscious that we're trying to represent a place that is real and idiosyncratic. And so I think we look for idiosyncratic looks and performances. I think that's something that matters to us.
David Simon and George Pelicanos, writers and producers of the HBO crime series The Wire. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with George Pelicanos, a writer-producer on The Wire, and David Simon, who created the show. There's something that you put in your book, in the Wire, Truth Be Told book, in your introduction, that a story that I hadn't heard about the audition tape by Dominic West, who plays McNulty.
Oh, that was beautiful. We had trouble casting McNulty. We had a lot of trouble casting him. We were all over the map. We wanted a guy who had a little bit of the rogue in him, but we also wanted to have a guy who was, he could play scenes without. There was a lot that the character was not going to be able to explain. He was going to have to play his cards close to the vest. He's got to be a manipulative character, and at the same time. Nobody was reading right for it. And this tape comes over the transom from England. Dominic had put himself on tape. He had his girlfriend hold the camera as he worked on his accent, and as she tried to avoid her accent while reading him the lines, they were basically cracking each other up. So he had to basically have her head out of the room. And so there was nobody to read lines to him. He didn't have a casting office. He didn't have a casting. It was, if you can imagine this, it was McNulty reads a line, stares into the void, waits for, you know, the appropriate amount of time for the line to come back to him, reacting to the line you don't hear, and then says his next line. So we watched the tape for about 25 seconds, and then Colesbury and I fell on the floor laughing. And then Clark Johnson, who was directing the pilot, came in, and he joined us on the floor. And it was like, what is this guy doing? You know, but you know, after we stopped laughing, we took a look at what he was doing, and even reacting to lines that weren't there, and we realized this guy's a good actor.
Yeah, if he can do that, imagine.
If he can pull this off, you know, God knows what he can do in a room with another actor. and so we had him come over from England. I guess within a couple of days, we were reading him in New York under better circumstances.
George, if I can ask you a question about television that you were watching in this genre, and I'll throw the same question to David afterwards. It seems like you're both so clear on what you want The Wire to be, but also so clear on what you want it not to be. Can you talk about some of the programs that are on television now or have been on recently in the police or police procedural genre that drive you crazy?
Go get him, George. Go get him.
Oh, this was a good question? This is a softball with a seam?
No, I'm just thinking, you know. Yeah, you're never going to work for them anyway. Go ahead.
No, I wouldn't name shows specifically. I mean, I'm definitely not going to name The District on CBS. It's one show I'm not going to talk about here. I think it's a general idea of you know, it seems like every time you see, for example, you know, drug dealers in a cop show, they're bad through and through, and they're in the show to elevate the cops, to make the cops seem, you know, seem pure and so on. And it's this notion of good and evil and the quest for, you know, I'm going to get that guy even if I have to throw my badge on your desk, Sarge, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some good, very good cop shows that were kind of, milestones, Hill Street Blues, the early NYPD Blue. I think these are fantastic shows, but you got to go back further. Is when I was a kid, I used to watch a show like The Twilight Zone, and you knew right away when you were watching it that there was something going on there in the writing, even though you had no idea what, you know, how a TV show worked, how it got up on screen. And I remember looking at, always waiting for the credits to see who wrote the episode, because it was real writers. It was people, you know, Serling came out of Playhouse 90. You had people like Richard Matheson writing. And I never understood why television didn't go after novelists and playwrights to write these shows, because we haven't been trained in a certain way. We just try to, for the most part, I can't speak for everybody, but we're just trying to you know, leave something behind that's worthwhile. And that's where this all came about. It's like, well, I was really into the fact that David wanted to try this experiment, because it's something that I really wondered why it hadn't been done before.
George, just to follow up on The District, because you are famous for your Washington, D.C. novels. So yeah. Here's a series that's set in that district. So you're telling me that when you watched it, you found something that may have bothered you in terms of its verisimilitude?
The idea that, you know, the District of Columbia needs a Great White Hope to come in and clean up the city and take it away from all those, you know, those Negroes that are ruining everything there. It goes back to, you know, I mean, it goes back to Birth of a Nation, basically. And for them to make a show like that in these, you know, at this point in our history is just, it's mind-boggling.
And David, your opinion of today's crime television?
You know, if I had to, this is going to sound a little bit pompous, but if I had to write a police procedural, I would just put my head on a railroad track and wait for the train. It's a police procedure to me, having covered it for years. It's basically what's in the toolbox, you know, to make something seem real and to tell a story that is credible. It's not the be-all and end-all. It's not what I care to write about. It's not what I think matters to society or the culture as a whole. In truth, you know, how crimes get solved is cops go down the street and they talk to other people. That's how crimes get solved. You know, the science of it is grandly overstated, particularly in urban areas that don't have money to create exacting police labs. It's not, you know, the finer points of law don't enter into the vast majority of criminal prosecutions in this country. It is an assembly line. And what I'm much more interested in than a crime story is the story of the city, is what's happened to American cities at the millennium, is what's been, you know, the wire's about what's been left behind in America. It's not about good guys or bad guys. It's not, you know, we wanted to be subversive to the extent of, you think you're watching a show about whether they're going to catch the bad guy or not. By the time you get halfway through a season, you start realizing the idea of a bad guy has less meaning than you thought it did.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not they catch him is not the point. The point is that the system is dysfunctional. And we're really making an argument. It's a very angry show about a policy that I think has gone awry. And I'm somebody very sympathetic to good police work, having written Homicide. But the drug war has gone hideously awry. It's become a war against the underclass in this country. And it doesn't work on a practical level in places like Baltimore. So we're sort of interested in having a political dialectic in this, and a social and an economic dialectic. And that matters more to me than whether or not they, you know, pluck the right fiber from the carpet and you know, the detective gets to call the bad guy into the room and bust him.
Mm-hmm.
I got no love of that. And so anybody who's going to approach it as a crime story purely probably shouldn't be writing for The Wire. You know, I'm really sort of hunting people who are using the genre of crime to say larger things.
All right. Well, David Simon, George Pelicanos, thanks for the great television. Thanks for the great conversation. Thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David Simon and George Pelicanos, writer-producers of HBO's The Wire. The third season started this week. The first season will be out on DVD, finally, on October 12th. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.